Good evening and welcome to Left, Right and Centre. I'm Vishnu Shom on the programme tonight. Perhaps the lowest point that we've been in relations with Canada, with the Prime Minister conveying to the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, his concerns over continuing anti-India activities. Also strong statements from Trudeau, who's accused India of interfering in the affairs of Canada. One way or the other, the issues between Ottawa and New Delhi over the issue of Khalistan and Khalistani protesters or sympathizers in Canada has resulted in the relationship taking a huge hit. Where is this relationship going from now? India can never accept the activities of Khalistanis in Canada, where there is, of course, a huge NRI population. Is there a diplomatic way of resolving this? Next up on the program, a big day today for India and Saudi Arabia. There's been a major economic agreement which both sides have gotten into. We'll be speaking to experts looking at the possibility of the India to Europe economic corridor and what it implies for billions, in fact. And finally, after the G20, it's time to look at some of the fine print. The biofuel alliance, which has been proposed by New Delhi, would perhaps be a major step towards the final adoption of all battery energy for vehicles, buses, etc. The Minister Hardeep Puri answers a basic question. Are we headed to a period? Will India be petrol-free? But first, let's just go through some of the key points mentioned by Prime Minister Modi to the visiting Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau on Khalistani extremism. He's conveyed a concern over continuing anti-India activities in Canada. He says that extremist elements are promoting secessionism and violence and that there's a nexus of organized crime, drug syndicates and human trafficking which exists in Canada. He's called for cooperation in dealing with such threats. Justin Trudeau says Canada will always defend the freedom of expression, that Canada supports conscience and peaceful protest, and that Canada will also prevent violence and push back against hatred, and that the actions of a few do not represent the actions of the entire community. Significantly, he also accused India of interfering in the affairs of Canada. Let's just listen in to what the Canadian Prime Minister had to say.
Over the years with Prime Minister Modi, we've had many conversations on both of those issues. Obviously, Canada will always defend freedom of expression, freedom of conscience, freedom of peaceful protest. That's something that's extremely important to us. At the same time, as we're always there to prevent violence, to push back against hatred. I think on the issue of the community, it's important to remember that the actions of the few do not represent the entire community or Canada. The flip side of it, we also highlighted the importance of respecting the rule of law, and we did talk about foreign interference.
All right, we even spoke about foreign interference. That's a key point mentioned over there. Well, to look at where Indian and Canadian relations are right now, we're joined by former Foreign Secretary, Mr. Shashank. Veena Sikri joins us as well, as does Terry Miluski, who's written extensively about the entire international Khalistan issue. Ambassador Shashank, would you characterize this as perhaps the lowest in terms of the relationship that we've had with Ottawa?
I won't call that. What I would say is that the Canadian Prime Minister is just too dependent on the Khalistani constituencies and their role of the activists within the Indian community in Canada. So this is, I think, a kind of an expression of political situation in Canada. I don't think he would go to the extent of spoiling relations with India. He has not given that. He has somehow understood Prime Minister Modi taking up the issue as an interference in the internal affairs of Canada. That is just not it. What he should understand is that India wants Canada-India relations to remain very good. And since we are improving our image in the Western countries, that it is not only non-aligned movement or friendship with the Russians and the Chinese, but we are trying to move away towards a neutral and involving everyone in the globe, especially global south, with us. So I don't think the Indians are against the idea of the people of Indian origin taking part in the political situation in Canada. Of course, they are fully authorized to do that, and most of them are very peaceful people.
Sure.
They want to be peaceful partners in the Canadian progress, Canadian society, but there are a few activists who are attacking the Indian diplomatic and consular representation offices, they are threatening the Indian diplomatic and consular representatives. Secondly, they are spoiling the atmosphere of amity within the Indian community or Indian origin community by damaging the Indian temples or various other places of worship. There is likely to be a reaction in India, and there might be protests against the Canadian mission or the Canadian visitors. So I think India is just trying to convey all these wishes very peacefully, very friendly manner to Prime Minister Trudeau. But we understand his problems. We only hope that he would be able to see through that India has only all goodwill in favor of whatever it sure. they want to achieve in Canada.
Mr. Milevsky, how has the Khalistani secessionist movement been allowed to linger in Canada in the manner in which it has for such a long period of time? I mean, there are places in Vancouver, some parts of Toronto as well, where people of Indian origin identify themselves as Punjabis, some as Khalistanis, and not as, oh, I'm from an Indian origin.
Well, the short answer to why they've been allowed to flourish over these many years is that they are politically organized and smart. They go to all the parties, not just the ruling liberals, and they say, look, if you sing our song and you look the other way when we have Vaisakhi parades full of martyr posters of gun-toting assassins and mass murderers, even to include the Kanishka bomber, Talvinder Parmar, if you tolerate all of that, then we can organize 10,000 votes for you. How do you like that? And they say, it's a deal. And so for years, they have been extremely astute in their political organization. The ruling Liberal Party has benefited from it, but I will say that so has the Conservative Party and, of course, the left-wing party, which currently sustains the Trudeau minority government in power. And that is the NDP, led by Jagmeet Singh, who, of course, as you know, is a longtime Khalistani sympathizer. So the politics are that if you pander to the Khalistanis, it's politically to your advantage. That should change. It's possible as a result of Modi's very blunt talk. And I think what this was the toughest statement I've seen. I've been following this since the 80s, early 80s, and that was the toughest statement I've seen from any Indian leader directly to Trudeau, saying, look, you've got people in Canada who engaged in threatening, inciting violence against Indian diplomats. He's referring to the killer posters, as I call them. Those are the posters put up showing Indian diplomats as killers of this character, Nijjar, Mr. Nijjar, in Surrey, British Columbia, who's very important, a separatist figure in the Sikhs for Justice organization, a temple leader in Surrey, BC, and he was assassinated, as you well know, in June the 18th, I believe.
Yes.
And India has been accused by many Khalistanis of being involved in that assassination. There's
fact,
no evidence
Mr. Minuski, that's what the Canadian Prime Minister seemed to allude to. I don't know if it was this particular case, but his last words were foreign interference. And, you know, he seemed to imply that India was somehow responsible for this. That's a bizarre statement to be making in India without a shred of evidence or anything of the sort.
Well, it is a bizarre statement, and it shows how the ruling class in Canada seems to have been captured by the idea put about by the Khalistanis that this is somehow an open and shut case, you know, that simply because they say that it was some sort of mysterious 007 Indian hit job to wipe out Mr. Nijjar and to wipe out Khalistani leaders in the diaspora, that this is somehow a fact. And that we should investigate Indian foreign interference. There is, so far as I know, and I've looked into it quite closely, no shred of evidence that India was involved in the assassination of Mr. Nijjar. And it's become a sort of popular myth in Khalistani circles in Canada.
No, absolutely, Mr. Milevsky. Just half a second. I just want to keep the strike rotating. Ambassador Sikri also with us. Ambassador, on the other hand, we've got incredible people-to-people connections with Canada. Our students throng to Canada. They receive an outstanding education. There's been a old historic relationship between two strong democracies. And then you've got something as ugly as this. You know, how do you assess these developments in the context of what has been an outstanding relationship?
Let me tell you that this has been getting from bad to worse since the 1980s. You remember that very cruel and tragic bombing of the Air India flight,
yes,
which was then investigated over several decades and, not even properly investigated in the beginning, but in the end, Babar Khalsa had been held responsible for it. But despite that, even at that time, the Canadian government held back and would not investigate it properly. So I think it is the height of experience in politics to say that because they are a well-organized political party, so they can play an effective role in Canadian politics. What is all this talk of human rights about? What is all this talk about saying that, we have good people-to-people relationship, but it doesn't matter. To get 10,000 votes, we listen to what the Khalistanis are saying. I think this is a call for a review of what goes into political bargain-making and deal-making. And Canada cannot at all try to take the high table at any discussion of any other situation in the world when they themselves in their own country are supporting secessionist groups. They themselves are facing secessionism in Quebec, but they're supporting secessionist groups in other countries. This is far too expedient. And I must say that on this time, during Prime Minister Trudeau's visit, after his discussion with Prime Minister Modi, he was looking distinctly uncomfortable. So as you said, Vishnu, you're absolutely rightly that this has never been spoken to in this manner. And Prime Minister Modi has taken it up absolutely with great equivocation. I think there's also the disturbing report that Prime Minister Trudeau did not attend the dinner hosted by President.
It's a fact.
Yeah, and this is very disturbing. Why didn't he do that? There is also coverage in the Canadian press that I saw today saying that they themselves are saying that Prime Minister Trudeau was given the cold shoulder by many other world leaders during the G20 summit. So obviously, I think adding up to all this, if you're a guest at a summit level in a country and you don't attend the dinner hosted by the Prime Minister of that country, what does
the
it
president
say?
In this case, the president of
yes,
this country.
By the president. What yes. does it say for your value systems?
No,
what
in
does
fact,
it say
yeah,
for
no, no, ma'am, I agree. Just, I wanted to get Ambassador Shashank in on this as well. Is this not, or could this not be seen as an effort at insulting New Delhi? I mean, the Canadians did respond unofficially by saying that, he was involved in negotiations through the day. Now, if somebody is indisposed, that's one thing. But Trudeau quite clearly wasn't. He was at Rajghat the following day. And yet he didn't go for the dinner by the president. Isn't that sending out a very wrong message?
Well, Canadians, I have been in Pakistan in the 80s. And we knew how the Pakistanis were supporting the Khalistani movement. And when I remember talking to the Canadian ambassador in Pakistan, and he said very clearly that yes, there is a possibility that there are these Khalistani people being supported by the Canadian state because they feel that like the Israelis have their Jewish communities in the West and Israel as a separate country, they would perhaps like to have in India an Israel type of Khalistan, which would then be having the Khalistani supporters in Canada. Now, point is that, yes, we have a very large number of people from Punjab in Canada, and they can have all these images. But why can't they think of Khalistan or whatever they want to do within Canada or within Pakistan? Why do they want to disturb the peace in India? So that is most important, what you have referred to, that giving an affront to the president, to the head of state of India. I think Trudeau is trying to do everything possible to spoil relations between Canada and India. India is doing everything possible that we have moved away from the 80s, as I've told you, to a situation where the Canadians at one time when I visited Canada as secretary, they told us that the Americans are very, very worried about terrorists coming from Canada. And the Canadian trucks are being asked to hang on the border for almost 24 hours in order to make sure that if there is any bomb, etc. being brought in, the 24-hour period would be over. And so most of their vegetables and fruits are getting spoiled. So I think Canadians have their own internal problem. Maybe they talk very freely, very nicely. I have no doubt about that, that ultimately they mean well for the world community. But I think there are these internal political compulsions. And I think Prime Minister Trudeau is really trying to do everything possible to spoil his image within the G7 and also within the new equations which are emerging in G20 and the world.
Terry Milewski, isn't it true that there are parts north of Vancouver City where there are strident supporters of Khalistan, virtual hotbeds of activity among people who are essentially secessionists?
Yes, I mean, they are claiming more than 100,000 Sikhs showed up yesterday in Surrey, BC. That's the second largest city in British Columbia, to vote in favor of the referendum on Sikh independence. It's become very advanced. And I think we should maybe just point to one element where Canada could, but at the moment refuses to make a difference to address Indian concerns. And that is the area where they go beyond just protest, which is freedom of speech. I defend that. Everyone defends that. Canada's not going to abolish freedom of speech in order to please India. Not going to happen. None of the Western democracies is going to do that. But most of the Western democracies have long since passed legislation to ban incitement or glorification of terrorism. The British, for example, did that 17 years ago. Why can't Canada do that? Because what they have been doing lately is going beyond normal protest into the realm of the glorification of terrorism. I mean parading through the streets of Brampton, Ontario, a vast diorama, a tableau of the assassination, celebrating the assassination of Indira Gandhi in 1984. I mean the killer posters labeling Indian diplomats as killers, endangering their lives deliberately, painting targets on their backs, and much else besides, where the Khalistanis in Canada have gone beyond normal protest into the realm of the glorification of terrorism by for example, one more, putting up life-size martyr posters of Talvinder Singh Parmar, the worst mass murderer in Canadian history, the Kanishka bomber of 1985, putting up his martyr posters on the outside of an important gurdwara in Surrey, BC. That's where this vote was held yesterday. So they've gone far beyond what most people would consider normal protest into the incitement of terrorism. And that is not illegal in Canadian law. So Trudeau can legitimately say, well, they're not breaking the law. Well, how about changing the law like everybody else has? That's an idea that would really get Indian attention. Oh, well, maybe they are serious about answering our concerns in a practical way and not just the occasional rhetorical, oh, well, tut, 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 but we're not going to do anything about it.
Ambassador Sikri, the Khalistani movement has seen a revival internationally in the U.S. We've seen attacks on Indian missions in the West Coast. We're talking about Canada over here. We've seen a horrible effort they removed our flag in London at our High Commission over there. Why is this happening, I mean, across Western Europe, North America?
You know, of course, certainly the Khalistani community is well organized outside India. But I would like to say at this point that President Joe Biden has indicated that it will not happen again and that they're going to take action. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak has spoken about it while he was in India, that it was bad that it happened, the wrong thing happened. And I think they have indicated some intention to do specific action against it. From Prime Minister Trudeau, you have nothing of the kind. And I'm absolutely amazed because I think within India, the Sikh community, so many people, so many leaders from Gurdwaras have denied this question of anything to do with the Khalistanis. And there's no question of having a separate Khalistani state in India. The people who are living in India, who are honest and good citizens of India, they have absolutely nothing to do with this. And they've said it again and again. I remember former Chief Minister of Punjab, Amrinder Singh, when Prime Minister Trudeau was in India and visited Punjab, Chief Minister Amrinder Singh, former Chief Minister, was very categoric in telling Prime Minister Trudeau that this is absolutely not, should not continue, and Canada should not support these groups. So when there is absolutely no support within India from any political party, from any community for this, how can a foreign government, that of Prime Minister Trudeau, just because it's politically expedient for him and there's an organized group who gathers a lot of money to spend on these kind of activities, says that this is what we want you to do? Why should it happen? The whole basis of international relations, of a community of nations, a committee of nations, of moving together on the basis of certain principles of the UN. UN Charter and humanitarian principle. All of this is being violated by in the name of certain laws that Canada had. What happened when there was a trucker strike in Canada? Prime Minister Trudeau came down on them like a ton of bricks in no time. He was so firm with them because, you know, schools were being closed and food was being affected. He came down on them, laws or no laws. He told them, you get back on your trucks or else. But how is it that it comes to Khalistanis? He forgets all these principles and relations.
And the Indian
community in Canada has been so important and strong and contributing. And look at the Indian students who go there. There are a quarter of a million almost Indian students studying in Canada.
Sully's the reputation of Indo-Canadians who've been such a fantastic element in Canadian society. Yes. They're participating at so many levels, at the highest levels of science, engineering, profession, their civil services, even in their politics. And yet you've got Khalistani elements just destroying that and affecting the image of this wonderful community in Canada. I'd like to thank you all very much for joining us. But really, I do believe that Indo-Canadian relations at this stage at a low, and that needs to be fixed desperately. Trade, economy, defence and cultural cooperation were the main topics of discussion between Prime Minister Modi and Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman Al Saud during the latter's state visit. During the high-profile meeting at Delhi's Hyderabad House, the two leaders co-chaired the first leaders' meeting of the Strategic Partnership Council, a bilateral agreement between India and Saudi Arabia signed by the two nations in Riyadh in 2019. For India, Saudi Arabia counts as one of its closest and biggest strategic partners, is what the Prime Minister said. India-Saudi Arabia partnership is crucial for stability, welfare of the region and the world. As far as the G20 is concerned, we've also seen a huge presence of Saudi Arabia over there.
नई जरूरतों के अनुसार हम हमारे संबंधों में नए और आधुनिक आयाम जोड़ रहे हैं। भारत के लिए सऊदी अरब हमारे सबसे महत्वपूर्ण स्ट्रेटेजिक पार्टनर में से एक है। विश्व की दो बड़ी और तेज गति से बढ़ने वाली अर्थव्यवस्थाओं के रूप में हमारा आपसी सहयोग पूरे क्षेत्र की शांति और स्थिरता के लिए महत्वपूर्ण है। हिज रॉयल हाइनेस के साथ बैठक के हमने हमारी करीबी साझेदारी को नेक्स्ट लेवल पर ले जाने के लिए कई इनिशिएटिव की पहचान की है। आज की हमारी बैठक से हमारे संबंधों को एक नई ऊर्जा, एक नई दिशा मिलेगी और हमें मिलकर मानवता की भलाई के लिए काम करते रहने की प्रेरणा मिलेगी। कल हमने मिलकर भारत, पश्चिम एशिया और यूरोप के बीच इकोनॉमिक कॉरिडोर स्थापित करने के लिए ऐतिहासिक शुरुआत की है।
Relations between Arabs and Indians, between Saudi Arabia also and India, beneficial relations for both countries. There was no disagreement at all during the history of this relationship, but there is cooperation to build the future of our country and create opportunities. Today we're working on the future opportunities. There is a huge agenda to be working with. We are working through this council to achieve these accomplishments, and these are promising. And I congratulate you on the management of the G20 summit and the initiatives achieved, including the economic corridor linking the Middle East, India and Europe, which require that we work diligently in order to create it into a reality. The Indians in Saudi Arabia had a large part in the economic growth of Saudi Arabia. Today they are 7% of the population of Saudi Arabia, and we consider them to be a part of Saudi Arabia. We watch and take care of them like we take care of our own citizens. We hope that this council will meet the aspirations of our people, and we wish us success.
Joining us now to focus on the India-Saudi Arabia relationship, I'm joined by Dr. Shubhda Chaudhary, editor for the Center for India and West Asia Dialogue. Thanks, ma'am, very much for being with us. Dr. Omer Anas, director for the Center for India and West Asia Dialogue in New Delhi. And very happy to have with us Professor Zikrul Rehman, the former ambassador and director of the India-Arab Center. Let's start with the big news on the possibility of, in fact, it's not a possibility, it's going to happen. A massive mega economic corridor between Europe and India. Firstly, let's talk about the basics. How exactly, sir, is it going to work?
This is a game-changing thing which is going to happen in the last many years. Especially, the region has been attracted by the Chinese BRI. Mm. And many countries, India was seeing that they are easily connected with them and they were being promised with huge benefits of the BRI. But these benefits did not come as they were expected. So in the last few years, India and Middle East trade, especially non-oil trade, has expanded much. And with this in view, India and Europe relations, India and Middle East relations, and especially India's fine balancing between India, Saudi Arabia, all the Arab countries, and Israel has also worked very well. So it was an opportunity for both India and West Asia, especially the Arab countries, to have a connectivity project in which all countries can play a role in a way that also answers or which also reduce the dependency of smaller countries on sure. this Chinese project. So this is happening in a way that is democratizing the trade space among the countries which was dominated by China.
Sure. Let me just get you in on this, sir. In simple terms, what does this imply? Are we looking at fuel flows coming into India? Are we looking at a more stable internet through undersea cables? What exactly, how exactly will this work for us?
No, this is not energy or, internet, etc. Let me tell you what exactly. It is basically the revival of spice route. If you see that in the past, there was a route that Indian spices, Indian silk, and, Indian pearls were being purchased by the Arabs. Mm-hmm. And the Arabs were taking it to from India to their own country, and from there they were exporting it to Europe. Mm-hmm. This was exactly the system that was flowing. It was only in the 19th century that the Britishers had tried to take in their own hand, and they tried to be intermediary, and instead of directly having a trade between India's Arab world and Europe, they had taken and they had controlled it.
Right.
So it is just a revival of the old spice route in order to ensure that all the trade, it is not only the energy, all the trade that starts from India or the trade which are, there in the Middle East or in West Asia. So we should continue and we should start again, reintroduce the same thing. See how from India the whole thing will go or the Indian products, Indian producers will go from here to United Emirates, and from UAE it will go to Saudi Arabia, from Saudi Arabia to Jordan, from Jordan to Israel, Haifa, and from there to European countries.
So just to be sure, it's data to oil, gas to goods. So it is all of these.
It is all of these.
Right.
It is all of these.
So it's more than just the original spice route. It's very substantial in terms of what it proposes.
Yes. So now, of course, with the new things that are coming up, so it is more than that. Energy is a part of that.
So that's what I was pointing out. So, ma'am, what else, in specific terms, would India stand to gain from this? And vice versa.
So the first question, I think, why did it happen?
Yeah.
And the timing of it. So when China was involved in creating a rapprochement or easing out a tension between Iran and Saudi Arabia, that is when the NSA advisors of US, India and all met and decided that there has to be an economic corridor along with a new quad in the Middle East or West Asia, which includes Israel. In the new quad, it will be Israel, Saudi Arabia, UAE, if there is a peaceful part of Abrahamic Accords, then the I2U2. Now, what exactly is this happening for? First, the diaspora of India, 2.6 million Indians who are there in Saudi Arabia connected, the Gujarat coast will be connected to the coast of Jeddah. It is investing, costing an investment of $18 billion. Along with it, the natural hydrogen clean energy cables that would be set up underground, which would be connecting the Indian Ocean because, as I said before, that the ripples of what happened in the South China Sea, all the regional powers and superpowers are scared about it. And the third most important thing is that in today's effort, in today's day and time, when US is trying to take a step back from West Asia in terms of military, it still needs to create some kind of power which is not geopolitics but geoeconomics in today's term. So these are very essential when it comes to navigating what it means. And it's going to make a massive investment for India, well, as well as all the countries that are involved, because it is also the emergence of a world which does not or would not like to trade in dollar. It is also the emergence of a world which is much more multipolar, much more symbiotic, realist in nature. And also the identities and interests of people, much more of fluidity when it comes. In a world which is now fighting for economic protectionism, it is trying to create its own narrative.
Sure. Yeah. Dr. Anas, what I find interesting is also what the US president had to say. And I quote, this is a big deal. This is really a big deal, a game-changing regional investment, building sustainable, resilient infrastructure, making quality infrastructure investments, and creating a better future, a future that presents far greater opportunity. You know, when we talk about resilient supply chains, it's a phrase which is used for everything, from semiconductors to fuel, et cetera, but this is actually ensuring that a lifeline, the economic lifeline which exists between India and several of the countries we've discussed, is protected, right, and enhanced.
First of all, I think that what we need to understand is that India is going to be the central country of this entire project. India is going to be the hub of all things will be produced here. China used to be and still dominates the entire supply chain. So any brief disruption in this supply chain can question the food security to everything. So replacing, I'm not going to say that India can replace China immediately, but mm-hmm. we indeed need a country where other countries can rely more. So India is going to be that kind of a place for the entire region, especially for West Asia, and from West Asia to European countries. So in this sense, yes, what we are going to become and what this project is going to become is to provide a secure and resilient infrastructure for from food security to other infrastructure, including digital infrastructure, which we are talking about. So in this sense, this project is indeed, as President Biden has also said, game-changing.
Sure.
So I think that we are heading in that direction.
So what I find interesting is that if you look at maritime safety and security, and which is incredibly linked with economic prospects, the Chinese have already got a base in Djibouti. They're looking to step up and create infrastructure. They already are in Gwadar in Pakistan. India's countering that with an investment in Chabahar in Iran. And now India is perhaps countering that with the creation of this linkage with Jeddah directly. So therefore, could you tell us a little bit about the maritime domain, how this is part of an effort at controlling the growth of China in the Indian Ocean region?
Look, it's not only controlling the growth of China. What we are looking at is the larger Indian interest, basically.
Sure.
Our larger interest is that our maritime links should be with the West Asia as well as with Europe. Now, you know, in the past also we had, you know, through the Red Sea, the trade. If you see thousands of years back, you know, Indian pearls and Indian, precious stones were being exported to Egypt during the Pharaoh's time. So there was a maritime trade between India and mm-hmm. the Red Sea countries. So this is an old thing. The only thing is, as I have very right from the beginning, I'm saying, that we should not see it as a new initiative in order to see. We should see it as a revival of this initiative. Whatever China is doing, they may be doing. So it's not that we should see only that we are trying to, play the Chinese card, or Americans are trying to play the Chinese card over India.
It's in our interest.
It's in our interest, in our larger interest, in our country's, our nation's larger interest.
Sure.
Yeah.
Look, I'd like to thank you all very much for being with us. It is such an important relationship for India at so many levels. There's a historic aspect of all of this, but there's also the futuristic relationship and, of course, trade and the economy center to it all. Well, one of the big takeaways at the G20 meet, which has just concluded, is the Global Biofuels Alliance, What exactly are the implications of this? How is this something that can actually benefit billions around the world? Joining us now, a very special guest, Mr. Hardeep Puri, the Minister. Thanks very much for joining us. Bear with me, sir. I'll ask you a couple of basic questions because people need to really understand what we are talking about. What is a biofuel?
Let me give you an understanding which I developed on biofuels. I was posted to Brazil, a country which is widely regarded as a pioneer nation in biofuels. And the Brazilians, you know, have one great advantage. They have three times our land area, one-sixth our population, and 22% of the world's freshwater reserves. So the Brazilians produced ethanol from sugarcane, and they became global leaders. The Brazilians produced sugarcane ethanol, and when I went to Brazil in 2006, I found that on a normal day, you could go to a petrol pump, driving a flexi-fuel car, and dependent on the price of petrol or ethanol on that day, you could adjust your car's computer to buying more of one or the other. Brazilian universities did research on Jetrofa, other biofuels. I was posted in the United States. They make ethanol from maize. And there was a trade issue because I think at some stage the Americans would have thought that a lot of Brazilian ethanol could come there. So if I remember correctly, the import duty was 54 cents a barrel on import of this thing. India's journey on biofuels didn't start today. It's actually, in all fairness, we attempted to do it many years earlier. When I was ambassador to Brazil in 2006, the then agriculture minister, Mr. Sharad Pawar, had gone to Brazil. The Manmohan Singh government decided to have a 5% blending policy in 10 of our states and union territories. But we ended 2014, Vishnu, just with 1.5% of biofuel blending.
Right.
In 1.5% meant we could produce or procure. No, we produced more ethanol, but it went into alcohol.
Right.
It went into other uses. 38 crores for mixing as a transportation fuel.
Right.
Prime Minister set himself a very, according to him, a very realistic and modest target. And in the next 8 years, another 10%. We had a target of 10% blending by November of 22. And now is the good story. We were able to achieve that 10% target 5 months before the target date. When we saw that we had gone up from 38 crore liters. By the way, we did a calculation in order to do 20% blending. We needed 1,000 crore liters of alcohol.
Right.
We were already well on our way to getting 10%. We revised the target. Don't wait till 2030. Let's do it by 2025. Brought it 5 years ago.
Right.
Today, we are procuring 566 crore liters already of ethanol from different feed. We are making it from sugar, largely. Increasingly now, starting now from maize, from agricultural waste, parali. A second generation, we have 5 plants from bamboo, from broken food grain, whatever. But the good news is that that 20% figure which we had, which was a mindset problem, dictated by two considerations. One is that the automobile manufacturers told us that if you have 20% blending, you don't need to change the parts or the engine of the car, which was self-serving advice, but well taken.
How do you respond to those who say that the moment you get into various blends, the efficiency of engines come down?
I'm coming precisely to that. They said that the efficiency would come down and therefore, you know, that engine can't take it.
So what is it?
There you get flexi-fuel engine. Now, what happens is, biofuels are being used in flexi-fuel engines all over the world by the same manufacturer. So it stands to reason if a Japanese manufacturer of a flexi-fuel engine can sell a highly successful car which does not have any acceleration problems in Brazil, he or she should be able to do it in India. Same for a German. A few days ago, we unveiled a car. I think it's a Toyota model, an Innova Hycross, which has a dual use, electric and ethanol.
Right.
Now, what happens is up to 40 kilometers an hour, if you drive it, it will work on the electric this thing. After, if you accelerate over 40 kilometers, it starts using the ethanol. But whilst it's using the ethanol,
it's charging the battery.
It's charging the battery. So these technological branches have taken place. By the way, since you are doing such an in-depth discussion, there were also people who said, don't go for biofuels. It will threaten your food security. Wait a minute. Today you've proved that in 9 years, we saved 73,000 crores on the import bill, but you were able to pay a farmer 76,000 crores. Today, the Indian ground level agro and fuel economics has proved that a transition into deeper use of biofuels is also good for our agriculture.
Okay. Is this a stepping stone towards the ultimate goal of moving to all electric?
I would answer that question very carefully. All electric, if the grid is not fully green, would be grey.
Correct.
Now, I'm going to put it this way. Biofuels is the most effective instrument, by which I mean ethanol, biogas, etc., most effective instrument for the transitioning to net zero.
Correct.
But it also will be overtaken by the time when green hydrogen will come. Your automobile manufacturer, I already have one of my major companies, which is now wanting me to unveil a fuel cell, a hydrogen fuel bus for
So how many years would this be affected?
You know,
before the industrial base exists for green hydrogen in India.
All right. I'm going to answer that question very cautiously. If you get 20% hydrogen, 20% biofuel blending,
yes,
by 2025, on which I can make a reasonable assumption,
yes,
we'll get it done. Between 2025 and 2030, you will see the pace being quantified. Because we are planning to do what, 5 million metric, 5 million tons of green hydrogen by 2025, I think is grossly conservative, inadequate. You'll do much more than that. If by 2025 and 2030, I move up the biofuel usage, and in comes green hydrogen, I think between 2030 and 2040, you will see fossil fuels fading away and green hydrogen slowly but surely coming in.
But depends on price.
No, price
that's the big problem with green hydrogen.
No, price will be viable in India. Why? Vishnu, the gas does not lend itself to transportation. So Indian companies are also already selling green hydrogen, green ammonia to Uniper in Germany. They've already contracted to sell green ammonia to the Singapore Electricity Authority, which are getting new GE plants, etc. I've signed an MOU.
Right.
And so what do you require? You require demand in a place, you require the production capacity in a place, and you require consumption in that place itself. Because you can't transport the gas. So if anybody argues with me that you can produce green hydrogen in a desert about 10,000 kilometers away, no, it will not be cost effective.
So it has to be developed in various
centers. So today, my first meeting 2 years ago, I'm 2 years, 2 months into this ministry, was with the U.S. Secretary for Energy, Jennifer Greenhalgh. I was very touched by a tweet she did. In that tweet she said, we are very happy that the Global Biofuels Alliance has been inaugurated. This is based on a deal done between Brazil, U.S. and India at the Goa meeting in July. She talked about 111. What is 111? 1 kilo for $1 for 10 years.
Okay.
Now, the price will come down. What do you need for green hydrogen? For green hydrogen, you need massive amount of local green power. We have demonstrated that you can bring down the cost per unit of solar. But more than that, see what your entrepreneurs are doing. There's one company, I won't name them because it will be a commercial advertisement otherwise. They've got plants all over the coastline in India. Right. Each one, 3,500 acres. What do there, Vishnu? They take the water up to a height of 2,500 feet and just drop the water. You need that green energy and you need an electrolyzer. I can tell you with confidence that it's large countries like India, Brazil, China, United States, where every electrolyzer manufacturer will go. Why will he go there? Because the consumption is going to take place there.
Okay.
So where are we? If I have to answer your question, Honestly, I don't know whether we are at $2 or $2 plus, but I think the price will start coming down.
It has to.
It has to.
Because demand will rise. Sustainable aviation turbine fuel. How much is it going to save us, number one? And number two, where in India do we stand with this? I know trials have happened.
Vishnu, let me first give you the global facts. There is a US company, Honeywell. They've already run a plane on 100% ethanol,
right.
Biofuel. They've run it. I know the CMD very well. He used to be the India in charge, a very good friend of mine. He's now the global in charge. We've had many discussions. But I'll give you the hard facts as I know them. We ran a trial on the basis of which one of our oil companies with Air Asia. They operated a flight from Pune to Delhi. And that flight from Pune to Delhi was on the basis of 1% sustainable aviation fuel. We calculated that if we were to make 1% sustainable aviation fuel mandatory for this thing, that is all aviation turbine fuel has 1% blending, it would become SAF. Okay,
right.
We would need 14 crore liters. That would directly benefit 500,000, 5 lakh of our farmers. If we mandate instead of 1%, if we mandate 5%, we will require 70 crore liters.
And so the benefit for farmers would be massive.
You know, if 1%, right. 5 lakhs are benefiting, I don't know, the same guys will do it or they will more will do it. Look, in one thing we've been able to do, which is not known in the public, in India, like in Brazil, of course, is because they have, God has been kind to them. You know, they have freshwater reserves, they have land, 1/6 the population. But in India also, movement for biofuels will end up helping your agriculture sector. If you're worried about food security, we are already diversifying the feed. We've just brought in much more of maize. We just did some price from about zero, it's gone to 1.7%. Agricultural waste, 5 plants, third generation plants will have gas. But more than that, you know, you are also utilizing the food part, broken grain, etc., which otherwise will not be used for consumption. That is the issue.
One final question, just coming back to the International Biofuel Alliance. What do you intend to do with this? How is it going to grow? Well, are you going to be sharing fuel with other countries, getting biofuel, or is it just institutional right now?
I don't want it to be personally. Who am I? My idea is not to make it a rigid intergovernmental organization where people are spelling. I want people who are actually involved in the biofuel business, Unica of Brazil, Grain Council of America, my people, my industrialists, all those guys who deal with biofuel, to sit down and brainstorm. We will do it virtually to begin with, and I am 100%...
So what is the goal?
Whose goal?
The goal of the alliance.
The goal of the alliance is to give a major impetus to biofuels per se, to deal with issues of definition, standard setting, technical specification, all that, in a real-time mission mode.
Right. By which time period?
Well, I think we'll get started. I was only waiting for that. The Honorable Prime Minister and President Biden, Lula, all the consuming countries standing there to see that. Once that picture is gone about, see the impact. The fact that a premier channel is interviewing me on biofuels means somewhere it has resonated.
It has to resonate. Otherwise, we are in deep trouble in this country. Thank you, Minister Puri, very much for being with us. So this really is, I would suggest, a stepping stone, but it's an important stepping stone as we try and meet our climate change goals, bring down carbon emissions, and also be realistic about how farmers and other groups in the country can actually earn and benefit from a transition to other blended fuels.